Mr. Constantino. Good to have you, Mr. Uberman.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Nice to see you.
Amelia.
Counsel, sir, would you like to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so you have
your argument's going to be that good. We don't need to.
You have 15 minutes.
If I don't get it on the first time, I'm dying.
Okay.
Practice won't help.
Okay.
In this particular case, the defendant was convicted by a jury of two counts of indecent liberties. It was a two-day jury trial. There are several issues that were raised on the appeal. The court granted the appeal on just the sufficiency of the evidence issue. There were a lot of issues in that particular case. The alleged victim was the daughter of the defendant.
Can I ask you something about your brief? On brief, you seem to essentially, the thrust of your argument was simply that there was no evidence that this actually, that there was any actual touching. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's because, Your Honor, there are so many versions told by the child.
Well, the statute doesn't require actual touching. A proposal is enough under the statute, and the indictment indicates that as well.
I understand that, but...
I'm glad you understand it. My question is simply, where's the insufficiency if a proposal is all that's necessary?
But is there a proposal? I mean, I think, you know, we have
a
child...
She testified that she asked him to touch her, you know, private parts, essentially.
She did testify that. She has given many, many inconsistent statements to that testimony, ranging from nothing happened to he asked me to, I guess, put it in my mouth, so to speak.
So it's a credibility issue.
It is a credibility issue, to some point, but I guess the question is there ever a time when a witness has said so many stories, so many different stories, so many contradicting stories, that a court at some point begins to have issues as to what really happened? And I guess that's the...
But wasn't she, at least with the neighbor, the child protective services worker, and the officer, generally consistent that he touched her pee-pee area, which she defined as the female genitalia area, or showed that on the poster, and that he asked her to touch his wee-wee, which was the male genitalia?
She said that to several people at different times, among other things.
Right, but is there ever a point, counsel, where she denied that specific?
Yes, I believe when she first met with a social worker.
Where is that in the record?
She said nothing happened.
So she said nothing happened, but when she described contacts, was there ever an instance where she wavered on the request? Not how many times or what actually happened, but on the request.
If you disregard the fact that on many occasions she said there was no contact, nothing happened, then I guess that would be a consistent statement. She said that, among other things. She said many, many, many different things, you know. And that's
the point. That's why a fact finder resolves these credibility issues. Can you point to a single case from our court or the Supreme Court of Virginia where a conviction has been reversed because of inconsistent statements made by a witness?
No, but I think we have, I mean, there is a great variety of inconsistent statements.
We weren't in the court. We didn't hear this witness testify. That's why we defer to fact finders in that regard.
And I think in the Attorney General's brief, they reference a case where there was a contradictory statement, and the Supreme Court said, well, that doesn't make the conviction invalid. But I think there is a significant difference between saying A on the trial date and B the day before, as opposed to saying A on the trial date and A, B, you know, a million other letters on other days. I mean, I think that's not the same. I think when you have two things.
Okay, put yourself in our shoes. You want us to write an opinion that basically says this is not like the others, and that's it? I mean, how no. From a legal standpoint, how would we distinguish this case from any other case where there were credibility issues with a witness that were resolved adversely to the defendant by the fact finder?
The court, the appellate court, in this case and every other case, is not just a bystander. They review the case, and they, although it is difficult to put yourself in
issues difference. Of law, we don't review issues of fact. And determining who's telling the truth, that is not our role.
I understand. But it is your role to decide when you read the whole transcript and the whole case, are we satisfied this man is guilty? I mean, I think that is within the court's purview.
And can we just substitute our judgment for that of the jury if it was a jury trial?
Well, I mean, it could. Let's give a hypothetical. What if the testimony was that there was a little green man that came and did X, Y, and Z?
Well,
and the jury said, okay.
Okay, then that would fall under the category of inherently incredible. But you're not suggesting that she's inherently incredible. What you're suggesting is that her testimony is contradictory and there's a difference.
It is
the exact example you gave is the difference.
And it is more than, I don't want to repeat the points, but I think it's more than contradictory to me at least. It means saying A on day one and B on day two. This is not what we have here. We have A and then many, many different varieties of other testimony from her, not in court, from nothing happened to everything happened.
But counsel, the case law is very clear that particularly a child victim will say different things depending on the context of who they're speaking with. And you had her talking to a neighbor who's a babysitter, you had her talking to a police officer, you had her talking to a prosecutor. And she talked to all these different people and was obviously at a different comfort level with each of them. And wouldn't that account for some of the, what you're saying, are the inconsistencies?
To a point, but she said a great many different things to the same people sometimes. And I guess talking about the police officer, we really don't know what she told Officer O'Brien. And the reason, I think if you read the transcript, is he had written in his notes, no, 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 as being the answer of the child, with no idea what the question was. You know, so, you know.
Well, counsel, can I ask you a question? You mentioned in your brief the issue of intent. But where was that raised below at the trial? Did you challenge, when you made your motion to strike, did you challenge intent?
I think I challenged all the elements of the offense, if my memory is correct. I think I challenged the whole issue. Plus, there was, I think, a post-trial motion to set aside the verdict.
Right, but that was on a different issue.
Well, I think, let me quote you. At trial, you said, quote, there is certainly a lot of different testimony on the issue as to whether or not there was any actual touching or she said no, whether it was squishy or not squishy, whether anything took place, close quotes. That was the thrust of your motion to strike. That's pretty broad in one sense, but it doesn't answer Judge Decker's question.
I think, Judge, everybody was well aware in court, you know, we moved to strike the case for all of the reasons.
But the rule is that if you're going to challenge intent, and the lasciviousness of this, the requirement of lascivious intent, that you have to raise that so the trial court can make a determination. So it's unclear to me where you raised that.
I think when I moved to, it was a broad enough, I would think, statement and a motion to strike to accomplish that. But, you know, if you guys decide that it was not, then it was not. But
okay.
To me, it was broad enough to encompass all of the elements.
We're just trying to hone in because we have certain legal requirements. We're trying to make sure we know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of things in the jury. I mean, I understand the difficulty once the jury, I understand that part. But it was a lot of moving parts, coming together with the jury. You hear the testimony of the neighbor who, multi-time felon, that he was a good friend with the mother. We provided them, perhaps a motive why they would make up the story. And, she had pending charges that they did not violate the probation on. When we ask her, there is no agreement. There is no discussion about any of these things. Which, common sense tells you, although they might not have had a discussion about it, I think everybody, we know what's going to happen. And in fact, it happened. After the trial was finished, they did violate the probation. She got a very favorable outcome. But that was part of the jury. The jury did not...
But even if you put her aside, you've got the Child Protective Services worker, and she, I think it was either she or the officer or both who said that the little girl was every time, I will not tell my mother about this because she'll be very mad at me. And she keeps... So it goes against part of what you're arguing here, the intuitive, the mother's... wants her to do this because the child is afraid that the mother will be angry with her.
Unless the mother told her that. And, and everything, I understand the argument you make around. I understand that. But a lot of things happen, and you all have seen a great many things. People do horrible things for their own motives. And I know this court has heard some, at least, the rich of actual innocence because of those kind of situations. So I do think that every court has a responsibility to give the deference that's due. That's one thing. But look at the whole record and, say, in my good conscience...
I think you should be sure we've done that.
In good conscience, do I believe that this person is guilty? And I think once, Your Honors, look at the whole record, look at the many, many... Not contradicting. We don't have one versus two. Great many variety of statements. I think you will have some doubt in your mind. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Uberman?
May it please the court. David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth.
What haven't we covered that you were going to argue?
Well, I guess that's part of my problem, Your Honor. I'm recovering from bronchitis, so I'm almost tempted to just let it lie there, but... As the court knows, to convict a defendant of taking indecent liberties under the statute, and it's code 18.23783, the Commonwealth only has to prove that it was lascivious intent that the defendant proposed that any child feel or fondle sexual or genital parts of such person or propose that such person do the same with the child. And in this case, the Commonwealth clearly met that burden.
And counsel, let me ask you...
Yes, Your Honor.
Was the intent raised in the motion to strike, the issue of intent?
Your Honor, my position is that it was not. I don't want to box myself into a corner, but other than me just quoting the statute, I don't believe the word lascivious was ever used in the motion or on brief by either party, other than when I quoted it for the standard set forth in the actual statute. It is my position that intent was not challenged.
Well, I understood the motion to strike. I asked your opponent about it, but I understood the motion to strike to be essentially an attack upon the credibility of the witness and as to whether anything happened or at least whether anything beyond a proposal happened. Would that be a fair... do you have a different take on that, on the motion to strike than that? No question. The word intent was never raised. The focus was on the credibility of the victim in this case.
Correct, Your Honor, and I think that's borne out by the arguments set forth not only in the petition for appeal in the opening brief, but also in my response, because I responded to the allegations that were raised, and that I perceived this as a credibility argument. And in this case, especially with respect to this insinuation that somehow, let's keep in mind the child was 5 years old at the time this happened to her. She was 6 years old at the time of trial. And the theory, the speculation put forward by the appellant as to the motivation behind her testimony was that it was some sort of ploy between the child's mother and one of the people in whom the child confessed or confided the abuse to, I guess, as a pathway to divorce from the appellant. And I think that argument fails because in this case, the jury was permitted to infer that the inconsistencies that we've been talking about in the victim's statements were nothing more than the attempt of a six-year-old child at that time to express something extremely traumatizing that happened to her in the best way that she knew how. And I want to be very specific in that when I'm talking about inconsistencies, I'm talking about inconsistencies about the details surrounding.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is there any, did she waver at all in the point about the proposal to touch?
No, Your Honor. With respect to opposing counsel, and she never wavered in response to Tina Sawyer, who is the social worker as well. What she was consistent about every single time, no matter who she talked to, whether it was the prosecutor, whether it was Officer O'Brien, whether it was the Child Protective Services Supervisor Sawyer, she was consistent that her father had asked to touch her vagina and that he had asked her to touch his penis. That never wavered. And in fact, with respect to, and I do want to point this out because it
was. I guess she did occasionally, though, say nothing happened, but then she'd go back to what you just said.
Yes, Your Honor. And what you're referring to is her conversations with Ms. Sawyer. On page 338 and 339 of the appendix, Ms. Sawyer on redirect says what has happened is she would initially deny it, and then, in Ms. Sawyer's words, she would clarify what happened. And that's consistent when the court looks at the record as the whole. This little girl was terrified to tell her mother what had happened. In her mind, she only expressed it at trial as feeling sad. But I think it's fair to assume that given her repeated statements to people who testified at trial, the police officer, the Child Protective Services, the neighbor, the CPS worker even wanted to institute a what she called a contingency plan if this were to happen again, who would be told. And the child did not want her mother on that list because, again, in her mind, she was feeling this misplaced guilt and misplaced shame. She thought she'd done something wrong. And I think that explains her initial hesitancy. That explains her hesitancy when talking to people outside of court. Now, at trial, I think it's important to note, now, a lot not has been made on argument today, but on brief, the appellant argued that, you know, the child's initial hesitancy, the judge asked her, you know, she testified via closed circuit television. The judge made some just opening remarks to her, and the child shut down. She didn't respond. She didn't answer. It was just simply, if you look in the transcript, it's no response, no response, no response. The prosecutor, who was female, asked to have a few minutes with the child, with the court reporter, who was also a female, present, and asked defense counsel, who kindly agreed to step out of the room, and he, I'm assuming, watched with the judge in outside the presence of the jury in the courtroom itself. But even the judge said on the record, and based upon prior credibility hearings in which the court heard evidence and argument, that the child was skittish and timid in front of the presence of men. It wasn't that the child did not want to testify. It was, and I think that's borne out by the conversation between the prosecutor and the child, where she says, the prosecutor says, do you want to get this over with? She says, yes. She affirms, I think, no less than four times that she wants to move forward. The only time she indicates any hesitancy is when the prosecutor tells the little girl that the defense attorney has to come back in. And that's not any fault of the defense attorney. It's simply by virtue of the fact that he was male. But I want to make it clear that there was not some external factor bearing upon this child's testimony, and I don't want that being lumped in together with that's why she's inconsistent, because there is, I think, a sufficient explanation on the record for why she chose to behave that way when she did. And when she responded, you know, if you look at her responses to the prosecutor versus the defense attorney, she is forthcoming with the prosecutor. She's nearly monosyllabic with defense counsel, and I don't think that should be interpreted, again, as inconsistency or hesitancy. It's simply that she was terrified to respond to men, which was what was on the record. Additionally, prior...
All that weighs on credibility. Yeah. All that weighs on the degree of weight any fact finder wants to...
Correct, Your Honor.
...which is not our role.
Sure. Yes, you're right. Because all that this court is looking at this point is whether any rational trier of fact could have found, and in this case it was a jury, how the jury found. And I think it's important to note that prior inconsistent testimony with respect to determining the credibility of a witness is essentially a matter of weight. And in this case, the jury clearly found the testimony of the victim credible, and they found the testimony of the defendant and his mother incredible. The defendant initially told police during interviews that he never was alone with his daughter. And that's an odd thing to say for a parent who has any amount of custody whatsoever with their child. He later clarified under cross-examination by the prosecutor that it was actually almost never, and that he had somehow mixed up those two concepts. The defendant's mother testified, with whom the defendant was living at the time of trial and at the time that these incidents happened, and she said, well, he had no more than 60 seconds max alone time with his daughter. But then she went on to agree on cross-examination that she would often leave the children with him when she would go to the store. It's very bizarre. And I think the jury, rightly so, declined to credit that testimony and instead credited the testimony of the child victim. And it's also important to note that some of those inconsistent details, which were referenced earlier, were actually allegations of additional abuse. This court held in Roadcap, I think very eloquently, that prior truthful accusations, sorry, that wasn't trying to brown us there, but I think Judge Decker, I may have inadvertently done so, it was not my intent. That prior truthful accusations, after all, simply reveal the unfortunate but irrelevant fact that the alleged victim has been victimized before, and they bolster and don't discredit that victim's account. And in this case, I think the Commonwealth made a good judgment call, and you can see that they over a period of about 9 months, which is the indictment period, they chose to charge the defendant with only two counts of indecent liberties. They didn't charge him with sodomy. They didn't charge him with any additional counts. Those simply aren't there.
Counsel, let me just ask you, there's a fine line between lots of inconsistencies that are up to the jury or the trier of fact versus inherently incredible. How do we get past, how do we determine we fall on the one side rather than the other side?
I think, Your Honor, the court looks at the record as a whole. And I think in this case, given the extremely young age of the victim, that it's entirely reasonable. I almost think it would be more disconcerting if the victim testified consistently every single time to every single person she had spoken to. That would fit more in line with some sort of rehearsed,
But not inherently incredible.
No, not inherently incredible.
So how do we make the determination that this is not, that all these inconsistencies do not equal inherently incredible?
There are two responses I have, Your Honor. The first is, I don't necessarily think the court has to get there because, again, she was never inconsistent about the actual two counts that supported the convictions for indecent liberties. And the rest, again, I would say that the court look at the record as a whole. Look at that this is a girl who was 5 when this happened to her. She was 6 at the time. She was testifying. And that some of these inconsistencies, for example, on cross-examination, she was asked if she remembered meeting.
I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I've always understood since law school the difference was simply that if it's absurd on its face, for example, if this child had said, the person who attacked me was 15 feet tall, that fact would be absurd on its face, therefore that particular piece of testimony is inherently incredible, not necessarily everything else the witness would say. That's my understanding of it. But I'm not sure that's what you're saying, so can you help me out?
I prefer your answer, Your Honor. I agree.
You're on a brown nosing ball,
No, Your Honor, I do believe that in this case, again, the example 4 was a little green man coming down. There's nothing in what I was trying
no
to get
little
to
green men in the testimony.
No, there's nothing of that nature, Your Honor. And the fact of the matter is that these again, I think it's more appropriate to call them inconsistent details. She testified she didn't remember on a cross-examination meeting with a prosecutor in December of 2013. She didn't remember meeting with him or her in January of 2014, another time in March of 2014, a second time in March of 2014, in April of 2014. These were all things she was saying, no, she couldn't remember. These were all things that were lumped into the inconsistent details. And my response would simply be that it relates to the memory of at the time a 6-year-old child trying to remember what happened previously. And again, not once did she say the conduct supporting his convictions never happened. That does not appear once in the record. If it does, it's later clarified by the proponent of that testimony saying, well, initially she said no or she denied it, but then she later clarified. And in almost every instance, she actually says that touching occurred. It's only with the Tina Sawyer, the Child Protective Services worker, that she says, she initially denies it and then says, well, you know, he asked me to touch him and he asked to touch me. And I think that simply given their standard of review in this case, that the appellant cannot overcome it. Again, the victim consistently expressed at every opportunity that she was terrified that her mother would be mad at her for this somehow. And I think devastating to appellant's claim is that on redirect, the victim testified that she still loved her father, and she testified the last comment she made on the record was, is it over? And those simply are not the words parroted back by a child who's been coached by some malevolent parent to secure a divorce. I think the jury rightly saw through that argument, and given the standard of review, I simply don't think the appellant can overcome it, and I respectfully request that this court affirm the appellant's two convictions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.